This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals outside the United Kingdom and the United States of America only. Welcome to the Medical Insider COPD by Boehringer Ingelheim, a podcast offering a breath of fresh air to clinicians treating COPD across the globe. My name is Dr. Richard Russell. I'm a consultant chest physician at Lymington New Forest Hospital in the United Kingdom. I'm a senior clinical researcher at the University of Oxford, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of COPD. I'm delighted to be your moderating host for this season of the Medical Insider COPD podcast series. I'm here to bring you news and insights in COPD right from the source to you, our listener. So thank you for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe and follow Medical Insider COPD podcast to ensure you do not miss any of the exciting topics in this series. Today, we're going to delve into a publication which I believe is worth reading and is brand new. This is entitled The Significance of FEV3/FEV6 in Recognition of Early Airways Disease in Smokers at Risk of Developing COPD, an analysis of the American Spiromics Cohort. I'm also going to look into an emerging and exciting topic from social media called lacing up for your lungs. But first, I am really pleased to introduce today's guest, my friend Dr. Mark Mavritlis, who's going to discuss with us the topic of mortality analysis in COPD and treating COPD. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Richard. It is my pleasure to talk to you today. I am Mark Mavritlis, chest physician working in Valldebron Hospital in Barcelona, and my main interest is COPD and also alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency.
So Mark, we're going to be talking about mortality and the benefits and risks of using treatment for mortality and understanding the studies of mortality. But before we look at that, let's talk briefly about guideline recommendation of treatment for initiation and follow-up of COPD. Can you unpack that very briefly for us?
Most guidelines agree that patients with COPD should be on long-acting bronchodilators. Long-acting bronchodilators are the basis for treatment of COPD because they relieve symptoms, they improve dyspnea, improve exercise capacity, and also reduce the risk of exacerbations. And only patients who, despite bronchodilation, are still having exacerbations, they may require other treatments such as anti-inflammatories and, in particular, inhaled corticosteroids.
Do you feel that the guidelines, you're someone who's been very involved in guidelines, really aligned up on this, ERS, ATS, as well as the GOLD strategy?
Yes. I mean, all guidelines recognize that bronchodilators are the basis of treatment. In fact, the GOLD strategy in the four categories in which they divide patients with COPD for initial therapy, in all four categories, they indicate that bronchodilators are the main option or the first option for treatment. And only in those more symptomatic and with higher risk of exacerbations, if they have a particular type of inflammation, a more eosinophilic inflammation, they may start therapy also with an inhaled corticosteroid.
This has been a theme from several podcasts in the past, and we'll come on, I'm sure, to talk about personalized medicine. But let's now talk about mortality and the importance of mortality as an outcome and mortality analysis. Mark, can you tell us a little about how easy or difficult this is?
Well, it is really very difficult because studies designed and powered for mortality as a main outcome need to be very large studies with huge populations and also follow for long periods of time, usually 3 to 4 years. And it is easy to understand that these large studies are difficult to conduct and very expensive. And therefore, we only have a few of such studies in the field of COPD.
We've also looked at the role of randomized controlled trials and real-world data when looking at outcomes. Mark, I believe there's a new mortality pooled analysis which will help us.
Yes. In fact, we have conducted and presented recently at the ATS a pool analysis of the clinical trials with two bronchodilators, a long-acting beta-2 agonist and a long-acting antimuscarinic agent, a LABA and a LAMA, compared with triple therapy. In this case, it was tiotropium olodaterol compared with tiotropium olodaterol plus an inhaled corticosteroid. And this pool analysis was carefully conducted to match for the clinical characteristics of the patients in order to avoid bias as much as possible. And the results show no difference in mortality between patients treated with the two bronchodilators or patients on triple therapy.
So very importantly, you actually controlled very tightly for those variables in the patients which actually might influence the mortality outcome?
That's true. I mean, it is clear that a pooled analysis is not a randomized clinical trial, and it may be subjected to some kinds of biases. Some of them can be controlled and some others may be unknown. But to the best of our possibilities, we match for the baseline characteristics that we know that can influence survival. And even after this careful matching, there was no difference in mortality between the two treatment arms.
Well, let's come on now then to discuss a couple of studies that have actually looked at mortality as secondary outcomes, particularly in the randomized controlled world, which have shown some different results. So we looked maybe at IMPACT, ETHOS, and TRILOGY studies particularly. How do they differ from the study you're just talking about?
Yes, well, these studies were randomized clinical trials, compared triple therapy with LABA-LAMA and also LABA-ICS. But I guess the most interesting comparison here is triple versus LABA-LAMA. And they showed a significant reduction in mortality in patients on triple therapy. The first observation is that these studies were not designed and powered for mortality. Nonetheless, a mortality analysis was conducted, and these were the results. However, we need to recognize that these patients included in these clinical trials are very different from the patients included in the previous pool analysis between tiolo-daterol and triple therapy.
So do you think then that some of these outcomes may well have been due to enrichment and increased risk, which we'd have seen in randomized controlled trials, which in a pooled analysis you're going to lose?
Yes, but not only. In fact, I think the main reason for the different results was that patients included in ETHOS and IMPACT were patients at high risk for exacerbations. These were patients who were already on in LABA-LAMA, LABA-ICS, or even in triple therapy. Up to 50% of them were already on triple therapy. And despite of that, they were suffering from frequent or severe exacerbations. So these are not the majority of patients in the community. So these are particular subgroup of patients with severe or very severe COPD and high risk for exacerbations. And in this population, there was a significant effect on mortality, and in particular in a subgroup of these patients. But the patients in the pool analysis were patients included in bronchodilator trials and therefore not enriched for high-risk patients.
One area of controversy with regards to these studies is always about ICS, inhaled corticosteroid withdrawal at randomization. If you're on triple therapy to start with and you come off the inhaled corticosteroids, do you suffer at the beginning an increased risk of problems? Mark, can you explain that for us and maybe see if that's been a problem?
Well, this is another difference between the pool analysis and the IMPACT and ETHOS trial. In the pool analysis, there was no ICS withdrawal. All patients in the LABA-LAMA had never been treated before with an ICS. In contrast, patients on IMPACT and ETHOS, up to 50% were on triple before randomization, and more than 70% were on ICS before randomization. And therefore, when they were randomized, half of them were randomized to LABA-LAMA. Those who were randomized to LABA-LAMA had to discontinue ICS. And we know from clinical trials that discontinuation of ICS in patients at high risk of exacerbations, such as those in IMPACT and ETHOS, they have a high risk of exacerbations, in particular if they have high blood eosinophils. And therefore, this could explain, at least in part, some of the results seen in these trials.
One of the things that we need to understand when we look at randomized controlled trials is, are they generalizable to the population? So let me ask you, do you think these trials are generalizable? And do you think maybe the pooled mortality analysis may be even better?
Well, this is very important, in fact, and it is important to recognize that these the results can be extrapolated to the population that are represented in the trials. And the population included in IMPACT and ETHOS is a population basically from teaching hospitals, reference centers, and that see patients who are more severe at high risk. So these patients had an FEV1 below 50%. The mean FEV1 was around 43, 44%. And again, on frequent or severe exacerbations, despite therapy. In contrast, we know that in general in the community, the majority of patients are infrequent exacerbators, and they used to have no or just one exacerbation a year. So these are the majority of patients that we see in the community and the majority of patients treated by general practitioners. So the results of ethos and impact cannot be extrapolated to the general population with COPD in the community.
You began at the beginning by telling us, you know, about baseline therapy of COPD, and we've now discussed how we may want to treat the most severe patients. And we've also mentioned eosinophils. So let's talk about personalizing therapy and understanding risk-benefit. So Mark, can you unpack for us briefly the idea of risk-benefit when prescribing inhaled corticosteroids over perhaps dual bronchodilators, LAMA-LABA therapy, and obviously risk of side effects versus benefit of actually the treatment?
Yes, I think the first that we need to acknowledge is that the indication of inhaled corticosteroids is the prevention of exacerbations. And therefore, ICS should be used in patients who are at high risk of exacerbations. In other words, patients who had exacerbations in the past, because this is the best marker of a future risk of exacerbations. And in particular, when we see these patients with frequent exacerbations, we know that those who have high blood eosinophils will be the ones that will respond better to ICS. And the higher the concentration of eosinophils, the better the response to ICS. In contrast, patients who have low blood eosinophil counts will not benefit from ICS, and they will be at increased risk of side effect, in particular, infective side effects such as pneumonia.
That's very helpful. Now I'm going to leave you with the hardest task, Mark. Perhaps you can summarize two or three points you think the audience should take away from this discussion we've had.
Well, this is not easy. The first would be that the basis of treatment is long-acting bronchodilators. Most patients will require two and will do better with two than with one. Patients who, despite two bronchodilators, are still having exacerbations, we need to look at blood eosinophils. Patients with high blood eosinophil counts must be on ICS in combination to long-acting bronchodilators. Patients with low levels of blood eosinophils should not be on ICS. And patients with intermediate levels of blood eosinophils are perhaps the most difficult to manage, because in them, we need to make individual decisions based on other characteristics, such as the frequency of exacerbations, the smoking habits, and the type of exacerbations. So exacerbations that are more infective are less likely to be prevented with ICS.
Thank you, Mark. That's very helpful. In just a minute, I'm going to talk about an important new publication and also a really hot topic from social media. But before I do that, I want to thank Dr. Mark Mirvitlis for joining me today on the Medical Insider COPD podcast. Mark, thank you for unpacking this really important subject for us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, Richard.
I'm going to unpack for you now a really new and interesting paper that I found in the literature on COPD. This is entitled The Significance of FEV3 to FEV6 Ratio in Recognizing Early Airways Disease in Smokers at Risk of Development of COPD. This is an analysis of the Spiromics cohort, published in Chest, November 9th, 2021, by Ye et al. The question here is, if we look at small airways in COPD, do they really matter? Does small airways dysfunction actually make a difference? And this paper was able, using the cohort, to look at FEV3 to FEV6 ratio to identify early abnormalities of the small airways and ask the question, did these abnormalities predict future problems, the development of COPD and even exacerbations? So what this group did was take 832 current and former smokers with normal FEV1 to FVC ratios, so no airways obstruction, and then measured their FEV3 to FEV6 ratios and followed them. Well, what did they find? Well, they found that if you defined an abnormal ratio of FEV3 to FEV6 using a lower limit of normal, that these patients had lower FEV1s, impaired quality of life as measured by a higher St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, increased levels of emphysema, and also an increased level of small airways disease as found on CT scan. They also found an increased odds ratio of having exacerbations and hospitalizations at 1 year. These people were more likely to develop COPD and have problems with their COPD. What was nice was, compared with spirometry alone, this FEV3 to FEV6 ratio was reproducible and repeatable. So it's something we can do out in practice. So what does this mean? Well, this means we may well be able to identify an early cohort of COPD using easy and simple measures of spirometry at risk of developing COPD. This also makes me think that we need to ask our patients the right questions. These patients had abnormalities, but did they think they had breathlessness or not? Well, maybe they didn't, but maybe if we asked about breathlessness, we may find more of them as triggered by the FEV3 to FEV6 measurement. And then finally, should we be treating these patients earlier, intervening with bronchodilators, doing rehabilitation with them and keeping them well and preventing them from developing COPD, obviously stopping them smoking? So, an interesting paper, and I would commend it to you. Have a read and have a think about its findings. So now, let's talk about the hot topic on social media at the moment. Let's talk hashtag lacing up for lungs. This is about wearing an orange ribbon or an orange color, lacing up your shoes and getting active for COPD. This has also been tagged with hashtag COPD awareness. So look out for it. The goal of this from the COPD Foundation, veterans organizations, celebrities, and even COPD News Today is really to have an active and healthy lifestyle for all, but particularly focusing on COPD. Their message is that breathing should not be taken for granted. 380 million people in the world have COPD and are struggling. So there's a whole load of promotional videos, tweets, and also the idea behind lacing up and get moving for COPD. The COPD Foundation is also providing a COPD awareness toolkit, which will tweet out and also engage the whole community to get laced up for your lungs and become aware of COPD. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. We've unpacked the importance of mortality analysis in COPD and how we should treat COPD. We've looked at a new paper in COPD looking at lung function and spirometry. And then finally, we've laced up for our lungs to get active for COPD. So thank you for joining me today on Medical Insider COPD Podcast, and look out for the next in our exciting podcast series. And remember, let's lace up for lungs and become aware of COPD and not take breathing for granted.